Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining me at the podcast today. I recently had the pleasure to talk right here in person, face-to-face with Chris Ray at UBC, since we both teach here, about his new book, The Age of Irreverence, A New History of Laughter in China. This came out in 2015 with the University of California Press. And as you'll hear over the course of the interview to come, we very much were talking in the spirit of playfulness and humor and jokes to a large degree, because that's very much the spirit of the book. So not only does the book offer a really interesting and I think impeccably researched and very, very thoughtfully argued and produced account of various kinds of humor in China, in modern China specifically, laughter and jokes, mockery, farce, all kinds of ways of embodying the comedic in very different ways in different contexts sometimes. But the book itself is also very much written out of a spirit of play, of playfulness, of humor. And that extends from an executive preface that you'll hear us allude to that's very much written in the spirit of a kind of Monty Python-esque skit, very much not what you'd expect from an academic book. And it's actually quite a refreshing kind of change of pace. There are also other little hidden jokes in the book. And Chris himself is just such a pleasure to talk to and really has quite a robust sense of humor. So you'll hear all of that come out in the course of the conversation to come. I highly recommend getting your hands on a copy of the book, in part because, among other things, there are all kinds of really useful, really fascinating translations of primary sources in the book, translations of jokes, of other kinds of humorous writing. And these are really, really interesting to read and think about and work through, not just from the perspective of Chinese history, but also from the perspective of the kind of craft that a lot of us who work in non-Anglophone languages practice, even if we don't self-identify as doing so, and which is translation. So there's some really interesting translation problems that come out in the course of working through the materials of the book. So I'll leave that there. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your support of the channel. And I hope you enjoy. I hope it's going to be very obvious that I did in the conversation to come. I'm here today at UBC to talk with Christopher Ray about his new book, The Age of Irreverence, A New History of Laughter in China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Chris, and thanks for making time and hoofing it all the way down to Buchanan Tower at UBC to talk with me today.
Thanks, Carla.
So, Chris, this is, of course, an exclusive executive edition of the New Books Network interviews based on the executive edition of the book that we're talking about. And listeners who have no idea what we're talking about either will or won't in the next hour. It's kind of an inside joke with the book. Let's start at the beginning. What brought you to the field of modern Chinese literature? Like, why China? Why modern China? Why literature?
China is big, and I'm attracted to big things.
Okay.
No, that's pretty much it. I started studying Chinese in college, enjoyed it, and spent some time learning Chinese in Beijing, Harbin, later Shanghai and Taipei, and always loved reading novels. Was able to, you know, after a jaunt through kind of insurance and banking, decided literature is more interesting, and so ended up in graduate school. And from a young age, I'd always been a fan of Monty Python, and so I was kind of curious if there was anything remotely similar in Chinese culture, and found a few good works that I figured could be made into a project. So that kind of got me started in this direction. But yeah, no affinity, no, like, you know, because Chinese food is so great that I thought I'd study Chinese literature. Not quite that. Yeah.
So I'll give a little bit of background, and this is again from the executive preface of the book, and there actually is one, and it's very, very funny. So I'm going to talk about the unfunny things of the executive preface to kind of situate us. You tell us in the preface that historian Neil Harris has described the cultural atmosphere of pre-Civil War America as, quote, an age of irreverence. Okay, so this is the title, happily exploding established rituals. Now, during the first decades of the 20th century, Chinese culture, again, as you tell us in the book, had a similarly dubious attitude toward authority. The May 4th movement of 1919 was followed by a series of other crises that fueled anxieties, in the words of the book, about China's future. So the book explores five cultural expressions of laughter that are sort of bound up in ways of dealing with and working through and working with these anxieties. Jokes, play, mockery, farce, and humor. And those are English translations for Chinese terms that I'm sure we'll talk about, or at least talk about some of them over the course of the book. So you've said a little bit about how you came to the project, this sort of engagement with Monty Python from a Chinese perspective or something like that. As a PhD student, though, what made you want to focus on this particular kind of materials, and what brought you to a decision to do a full project on this topic?
I read a lot of really dreary modern Chinese literature during graduate school, and there's kind of the tears, suffering, and I'd watched a lot of fifth-generation Chinese films, you know, Zhang Yimou, Chiang Kai-ge, a lot of kind of cultural revolution trauma. Then in graduate school, got into reading, you know, some earlier works that were dealing with the fallout of the Boxer Rebellion or the, you know, Taiping Rebellion or, you know, Choose Your War. And a lot of that stuff was really interesting, but it also could be a bit repetitive. And this is a problem, you know, that's very well known in trauma studies. And I think the kind of trauma studies aspect of modern Chinese literary and cultural studies is very well developed. So I felt like that part of the modern Chinese experience had been pretty well taken care of. Still plenty of good work to be done, of course. But, you know, I had this kind of personal interest in comedy, felt like it hadn't been written about that much. Like, you know, everybody could name, okay, Lao She, Chen Zhongshu, you know, and a few other people, Lu Xun, you know, are like famous humorists, and had kind of approached that from a very biographical perspective, you know, critical biography, and you just focus on these different auteurs of humor. But I was curious about how, like, the whole spectrum, like, from, you know, ephemera, from, you know, mass culture and popular culture, from, you know, semi-literate people all the way up to kind of the, you know, the elite, you know, professor academy class, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a lot of the famous literati from that period were professors and, you know, founded journals and the like. So I wanted to get a kind of comprehensive portrait, and dramatists too, a lot of people who worked in the stage as well. And so it's kind of a process of exploration. You know, I found some works that were funny. I definitely crowdsourced a lot of things. And then, you know, once I had kind of critical mass of material, I was trying to think of, you know, well, what strategy, what methodology am I going to use to kind of make sense of this? And what I, you know, came up with was, well, let's just focus on the key words that people in China at that historical period used to talk about humor, like to symbolize humor. And then, so, you know, how would we kind of map that constellation? Mm-hmm. And, you know, was the term like yoshi, play, tied to a particular sensibility that was different from huaji, mm-hmm. which also meant comedy, mm-hmm. But also had kind of farcical connotations. And so that ended up being kind of the structure of the book. So different from that kind of author-focused approach.
Okay. So is that one of the major ways that the dissertation transformed into the book, sort of moving from a focus to the author, on the author, to a focus on these major concepts? And if so or if not, can you talk a little bit about whatever transformations did happen from dissertation stage to book stage?
Yeah. It's always when invited to speak about one's dissertation, right, on juvenilia, we all get a little fuzzy about the details. Mm-hmm. But dissertations are often kind of a compilation of material with like a loose thread of narrative running through them. So I don't think mine was much of an exception in that regard. But one of the things that was different is in the dissertation, it had a much broader historical scope. So it went, you know, there are a couple chapters on the war, the anti-Japanese war. Mm-hmm. What was going on in the interior, what was going on in occupied Shanghai. There was a whole chapter on cartoons, mm-hmm. the manhua culture, and the periodicals and the famous cartoonists of that period. Another chapter on cinema, specifically early sound cinema. And there were a lot of kind of vaudevillian comedians, Han Lan Geng, Yin Xiu Chen, and who were kind of Laurel Hardy types and did a lot of slapstick humor. So I actually narrowed things down quite a bit, and but did move in more of kind of a keywords approach direction for the book, a bit more systematized. So, for example, in the dissertation, I had kind of done this exploratory reception history of a novel called Witch Classic, He Dian, which was discovered by all these like May 4th Chinese intellectual luminaries in the 1920s. But I had done that kind of as a, you know, just a case study. And then for the book, I rewrote that chapter significantly, focused on the notion of ma ren or xiao ma, you know, like humorous mockery or invective for laughs, you know, when you're kind of mocking people to get laughs. And so that kind of helped me rethink the implications of that particular moment in Chinese literary history. And I went much broader into the literary periodicals of the period to see how much, indeed, people were cursing each other, right? These refined, you know, overseas students now teaching at Beida and Tsinghua and whatever. And so, you know, why was cursing suddenly so important? And it was not, you know, confined to like one segment of the literary sphere. It was all over the place. So, like, so throughout the book, you know, that's one of the ways I kind of try to use these keywords to say, it's not a new literature thing. It's not a so-called Mandarin ducks and butterflies thing. Often you have similar techniques or similar writing styles being used to people all across the literary spectrum.
Right. So let's get right into the book. So the first chapter, Breaking into Laughter, introduces a figure that we'll come back to. This is Wu Jianren. Now, he was, as you call him, one of the first prolific Chinese joke writers of the modern age. Now, in 1903, he began serializing two novels, A History of Pain and A New History of Laughter. And so right from the beginning, the book is introducing us to this relationship, laughter and pain. Can you maybe open up the book for us and open out into it by talking a little bit about the significance of that relationship for you in terms of the work that the book is doing?
Yeah, and I thought that the case of Wu Jianren, who was indeed a very prolific writer, and he worked in all genres, you know, fiction. He compiled like riddles, jokes, wrote essays, you know, worked a lot in the tabloid press in Shanghai, traveled around quite a bit. He was an interesting figure who I think represents this the pattern that in modern China in that period, writers did work in many different genres and different kind of tonalities, or I guess you could say they had different effective kind of effective strategies, you could say. So it wasn't like he was just chronicling the pain of modern China. He also found a lot that was like absurd or ridiculous or just funny and not so tendentious. And, you know, the biggest cliche about the humor of this period is that, oh, it was just a cover for pain. So I don't view it quite that simply. I do think that there is a complex relationship between them. I also see that there are a lot of kind of standard, you know, almost cliched tropes that you get over and over. So History of Laughter, Xiao Shi, was one that keeps coming back again and again. It was like how you, you know, in the Shenbao newspaper, you know, in your collection of jokes and, you know, doggerel verse and the like, that's what you would call it. That was just like this broad category for funny stuff. And like you can just throw anything into that cauldron. So Wu Jianren, I think, was participating in that. And I think he was interested because one thing you see a lot with writers of that period is they really wanted to like tap into some emotional vein in their readers or their listeners if they're later on radio. And they wanted some emotional response. And they were also competing in a print market that was very, very, very competitive and got more so into the 1930s. And so they wanted to offer this like immediate payoff. So that's part of how I view laughter and pain, right? Kind of tears and laughter in as being indicative of a kind of a similar impulse.
Great.
I do point out that, you know, in the case of Wu Jianren, Tongshi, the history of pain, did appear at the beginning of the journal, and Xin Xiaoshi, a new history of laughter, appeared at the back. So I still think that that was a convention, right? That even the practitioners of, you know, joking and like would sometimes belittle their product as well. But again, it was so prevalent that I think it deserves to be taken seriously.
And the fact that it's a history of pain and a history of laughter,
exactly.
It, you know, speaking to something that you just mentioned also helps us, I think about what history, what Shi meant in this context, which is not necessarily what we think of immediately now when we think of history. I think the book talks a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, and I'll be very curious to see if historians, you know, evolve any new theories out of this Xiao Shi notion, where Xiao is a modifying Shi, right, a laughable history or absurd history. And I know I was surprised to come across an earlier, like, Lei Qing joke book where they talk about this explicitly in the preface. It's like, you know, a Xiao Shi can expand the minds of those who think about history. And so, you know, it's very, a lot of humorists, you know, worldwide are very self-reflexive people and, you know, love word games and, you know, love that type of wordplay. So I think that transitioned to the modern period. But and I call the book an age of irreverence in part because, right, you can be irreverent for different reasons, for different motivations, because you want to attack the past and attack the old authority figures, or because you want to defend the past and you think that like these new regimes and kind of new cultural standards are absurd. And so I think that you know, by calling the book The Age of Irreverence, I was trying to say that you have multiple things happening from people across the political and literary spectrum.
Great. So as we move into the second chapter, or chapter two, rather, after the executive preface and the first chapter, we move into a chapter on jokes. Right now, during the late Qing publishing joke books sort of took on new functions. And you mentioned that during the late Qing, jokes became staples of the entertainment press. Right now, in the early Republican period, as you tell us here, jokes appeared in periodicals from newspapers to university literary journals. So we have the kind of printing and publishing and circulation of jokes happening in a new way in this period. A new class of professional writers, as you mentioned here, became well known for being joke tellers, and they were writing in a number of different kinds of forms. And the second chapter actually takes us into some of these, and they're really fascinating. They include genres called joke novels. They include standalone joke books. You talk about more than 100 Chinese humor collections, and that was a conservative estimate, I think, being published between 1900 and 1937. So there's a lot we could talk about, and we could probably spend the next hour just talking about that, and we won't. And instead, I want to sort of ask you to talk a little bit about what you think is most interesting about these texts. So specifically, you call Shanghai here a center for humor writing. In your research, and perhaps for this particular kind of humor jokes, what were some of the most interesting and exciting sources that represent the kind of print and publication that jokes were taking in this period in Shanghai?
Sure. Yeah, and there's a lot of scholarship on pre-modern Chinese jokes, like these great dynastic you know, joke collections, especially from the Ming Dynasty, Qing Dynasty. There are a ton. They've been very well cataloged. People have done extensive comparisons of like how jokes were adapted or changed, and the like. Really, really fascinating stuff. Most historians or scholars of these types of collections stop at the late Qing or at the mid Qing, and my suspicion is that's because all that early stuff was like definitively Chinese. Whereas once you get into the late Qing and Republican period, you get a lot of like foreign influences and the like. And so there hadn't been much study of that, of this period. So I started, you know, collecting these joke collections just to see what was out there, and eventually ended up with, you know, quite a bunch. And I kind of looked at, were they written in classical Chinese? Were they written in vernacular Chinese, or some kind of mix? You know, what was the actual content of these things? So it's often not just, you know, knock-knock jokes or kind of A-B-A-B types of dialogues. You would, again, get verse, you would get essays, you would get short stories. So it's very miscellaneous. People often talk about the late Qing and Republican period as being so open and so kind of searching that is very za. It's like the age of miscellany. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that can be reinterpreted in a few contexts. So I do think it partly explains why you get so many joke books. You know, people are just looking for entertainment, and you know, it's a relatively cheap way to reach readers. So there's a big market. The barriers to entry were very low, and so you get a lot of people doing it. Another is kind of the vaudevillian, what I think of as a vaudevillian energy, mm-hmm. that, you know, I'm not an expert on vaudeville, but a lot of people talk about it as being related to modernity. And so I think that you have some similar impulses that you see in like late 19th century America, mm-hmm. where there were people who like made a living just writing jokes mm-hmm. for the press, because there's constant demand for new copy. And people would adapt jokes into cartoons, write comic strips around the turn of the 20th century. And some of this, the statements and some of the types of joke collections that China's jokesters were making and compiling around that period seemed like a similar impulse. But you know, I wanted to go beyond the kind of China had it too thing to look at, well, you know, a joke is a joke is a joke. But, you know, xiaohua in Chinese can mean a couple different things. It can mean, you know, a true anecdote,
right.
or story, right? Some experience that I had or something I overheard, which I'm now relating to you, or it can mean something completely fictitious and made up, you know, a spurious story. And I thought that it was, jokes are significant in this period because the kind of print culture and the journalistic element in literary culture, mm-hmm. right, where people were borrowing from the news media extensively in order to write fiction, mm-hmm. that this started to create a new type of genre of, again, the joke novel, mm-hmm. where it didn't matter whether the event was true or not, right? The main thing is that it was funny.
Right.
And so that this became a way that people started writing novels in the late Qing dynasty. Mm-hmm. So I talk a little bit about that. I also talk about, again, this explosion of joke books, joke book publishing, especially after the founding of the Republic, and how you even got highbrow writers like Zhou Zuoren, right, Lu Xun's brother, getting into the business as well. There was some remarkable, you know, joke scholarship. People discovered these old editions, you know, they punctuated them, they republished them, you know, they started doing scholarship, and made some very interesting comments. So like Zhou Zuoren observed that traditionally a lot of joke compilers had been southerners, they've been from southern China. And so I looked at, you know, well, who had compiled the joke books in the Republican period? And indeed, a lot of them were still Southerners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of observations you can get from looking at these materials.
Great, thanks. So as we move to the third chapter, we move to a chapter on play. Now, this chapter looks at the spread of what you call an entertainment ethos of play, or yoshi, in tabloids and in humor magazines. This is a really, really interesting chapter for lots of different reasons. Now, in addition to talking about popular humor magazines, one of the kinds of sources that you bring us into are fantasy novels, right? And you talk about fantasy novels that imagined ideal futures for China. And this is, you talk about this in the context of what Michael Gibbs Hill has called future perfect, right? China's future perfect. Now, there are a couple of examples, at least, that you talk about, but one of them is Liang Qichao's The Future of New China. Can you talk a little bit about that in this context?
Sure. Yeah, and the chapter on play is, I think, the most miscellaneous in some ways. That and the joke chapter or two, the new ones that I wrote just for this book. And the play one gets into a lot of different cultural phenomena. It talks about literature. It talks about, you know, essays and print culture. It talks about cartoons, but also new technologies like cinema, photography, and how there was kind of a spectrum that was all encompassed under this term yoshi. So in the case of Liang Qichao's famous unfinished novel, The Future of New China, this was a novel, I think he only published like four chapters of it in Yokohama, and the journal New Fiction. And I call it, you know, entertaining possibilities, because they found something. There's partly a didactic impulse, right? We want to say like China's current governance structure is terrible. We need something that's more, you know, perfect. And so he kind of painted this idealistic portrait. And in the novel, right, there's a Shanghai Expo, and you have foreigners from around the world coming to China. China's the center of the world. It's a model nation. It's an intellectual leader. And you have a descendant of Confucius, mm-hmm. right, giving a speech and looking back on the last 60 years of all the great progress China's made up till presumably 1962. Right, this was written in 1902. Mm-hmm. And so it's a famous novel partly because Liang Qichao is a famous intellectual, and right, he does have a lot of programmatic things to say about China. But there's another text within the text, and that there's this other guy, Di Baoxian, who later became an editor of a major newspaper called Shibao, right, the Eastern Times. And they have a lot of in-jokes. There's like the running jokes within the narrative. So you have like a commentator who writes these so-called eyebrow comments that appear at the top of the page, and then interlinear comments that respond directly to this ongoing narrative. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like a bantering comedy duo. And, you know, Mr. Confucius, you know, his descendant makes some jokes of his own, but mostly it's kind of a jocular take on imagining future possibilities for China. I'm not going to try to repeat any of the jokes here, mm-hmm. but that's a text that I think had been kind of erased. You know, most people have forgotten about it or don't know about it. And even within the context of this kind of banter between the two of them, Liang Qichao himself makes some mistakes. Like you can discover mistakes that he made in terms of like calculating the time of what's happening when. But again, I feel like that mode of openness and futurism mm-hmm. did also open up space for a type of play. Mm-hmm. And you can look at this in a very material context as well. Just a few years later, this tradition of like literati commentary mm-hmm. on texts being replicated in like the machine print age starts to disappear. Mm-hmm. So it was a unique period in the late Qing where they were trying to replicate this old literati technique where you can make like quips about whatever text you're annotating. And so they were doing that in this, you know, very, you know, seminal novel. But then that starts to fade out and play transforms into other forms.
Great. Now, the chapter also, and we'll kind of move on, even though I would love to talk about, you know, amusement parks and funhouse mirrors and split cell photography. There's so much else going on in this chapter that's really fascinating, political cartoons. So listeners, I just want to mark this so that you have a sense of the variety of kinds of materials that are brought to bear here. Again, like ha-ha mirrors and like photographs, and it's just amazing. But the chapter is also making a large point that, as you call it, or as you put it here, play was a civilizing force, right? So it's not just that, at least it seems to me from the chapter, thinking about the future opened up a space for being playful and for playfulness, but also play was a way of moving toward possible futures, right?
Yep.
Okay. Cool. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and a play was meant a lot of different things to different people. I think the notion of it being civilizing was very seductive, very interesting to reformist intellectuals. It was also, you know, some people look at the late Qing novels like Liang Qichao's as being expressions of desperation, like we're so desperate for anything, you know, other than what we have in the present. Let's look to the future. I think there's some element of truth in a lot of that. But one of the things that I emphasize in the play chapter is that there is this kind of relentless exploratory and open-minded attitude. And it's open-minded not just towards kind of visionary political thinking, but also to like devices, mm-hmm. right? Machines, new technologies. So I talk about photography and filmmaking and emphasize that because this was something that was truly new and modern. Mm-hmm. Photography had been around for a while, but you had all these kind of double or multiple exposure techniques that we could, you know, so you could have two versions of yourself or five versions of yourself appearing in one photograph. So you could interact with yourself, you know, in a simulated fashion, thanks to this miracle of modern technology. And then so you have this being replicated also in moving images as well in the cinema. And so I kind of trace how that works and also how new visualities were connected to, you know, as you mentioned, these new amusement palaces that were springing up, you know, major capital backing them. And they were going to be have something for everyone. So for a nominal fee, you can come in and entertain yourself, right? The new world, the great world were like the places to go to for everyone from outside of town for several decades. And they were important also in kind of breaking down some of the barriers between parts of the cultural hierarchy. So in the 1930s, some of these amusement halls got a very seedy reputation because you had the mob getting involved in them. But for a while, you know, you had a lot of big-name writers who were, like, writing advertising copy or working for the daily newspapers that these institutions put out. And so I think you have a lot of really fascinating forces. And again, I do think that there's more to be said about kind of the vaudevillian style of variety entertainments. But some things that other historians have noticed, like split-cell photography, could be viewed as just a bourgeois pastime, but I think are also part and parcel to a bigger modernity project.
Great. So as we move from play to mockery, we move to another really, really interesting set of sources. Now, Chapter 4 looks at mockery specifically. And you introduce us to this idea by introducing us to lots of different kinds of things that were going on early in the chapter. So you let us know that reformists were sometimes adopting a tone of mockery in their efforts to speak against both Confucianism and against the Manchus. You also talk about Lu Xun. Now you've already mentioned Lu Xun a little bit in our conversation. I'm not going to ask you to talk at too much length about him now. We'll come back to him later. But you do mention the importance of the figure of Ah Kyu, right, to the story of mockery. I think he's called in this chapter, to this day, the most famous indictment of the Chinese national character. So I just wanted to mention that because we've just finished talking about civilizational natures of play and sort of futures and identity, and this seems relevant. Okay, but I need to ask you about this particular book that you mentioned here, Witch Classic, He Dian, right? In 1926, linguistics professor Liu Fu republished Witch Classic, He Dian. Now, this is a fascinating text. There's all kinds of things happening here. Let's start at the beginning. What is this text, and why is it so interesting in this context?
So this is a novel, kind of a mid-length novel, just 10 chapters, written maybe Jiaqing and Qianlong era, so kind of late 18th, early 19th century. We don't know exactly when. We know very little about its author, but it's a novel written largely in Wu dialect, so kind of Shanghai, Suzhou region, a mix of dialects, some Mandarin as well, some classical Chinese, but it's a novel set in the underworld, right? It's set in hell. And it's populated entirely by ghosts or devils, right? Gui. And so you have, you know, living ghost or living devil as the son of, you know, a rich local devil who is kind of a stereotypical or stock scenario from traditional Chinese fiction of like the rich man who's at middle age and doesn't have a son. And so he and his wife go, and he goes to pray at a temple. In this case, the Temple of the Five Organs. And if you pray at the Wuzang Miao, right, you're going to, that means you're going to have a lavish banquet. And so he ends up, you know, defecating in a grave or something because he's eaten too much after that spell. But he indeed, his wife gets impregnated by another devil, like a devil spirit, and gives birth to the living dead. So there's all of the novel is populated by these ghost devil characters, right? You have sex fiend Se Gui, right? You have Miss Stinky Flower Chou Huanyang, and you know, we have a devil beater Liu Dagui, who turns out to be an abusive husband. So this is there are no humans in this novel. It's all devils, and all of the devil characters' names are curse words. They're like cursing expressions. Some of them are particular to the Wu region. Some are, you know, you find them around China. A lot of them are still being used today. So this is a novel populated by curses. And there's part of the focus is attacking the kind of Confucian orthodoxy and like sacred texts and the like, mm-hmm. and kind of book learning and like the, you know, the false promise of, you know, you study the Confucian classics and then you become an official. That's not so easy. It also attacks, you know, corrupt local officials who make things difficult for the populace and, mm-hmm. you know, steal people's property. So there's a lot of outrage closed within this very farcical, you know, mocking text. And so it's a very bizarre plot, which I won't attempt to summarize here. But I thought, wow, like here we have a work that really explores the aesthetics of mockery. Mm-hmm. And so I became curious, you know, if you take mockery as a type of literary aesthetic, mm-hmm. or a mode of expression, you know, how do you analyze that? And so I use this novel partly as an entryway to talking about one Chinese motif, gui, right, devil, ghost, which is, you know, a ubiquitous type of curse and one that suggests a type of familiarity. Like if you curse someone as being a gui, mm-hmm. whether they are a yang guizi, like a foreign devil, or a jiu gui, you know, a drunk devil, someone who's always inebriated, it's something you're familiar with. Like you recognize them because mm-hmm. you've seen it, you've seen the type before. So it suggests a type of familiarity, but one that's also, you know, very, very degrading. And so I was curious, you know, I discovered that this novel had an enthusiastic reception among, you know, leading literary, you know, avant-garde literary types in the 1920s. And I became curious about, like, why were they so interested in this novel? You know, why did it speak to them in the kind of post-May 4th era, during the warlord era? And how did they talk about it? And one thing I discovered was that Lu Xun was famous at that time, to be sure. But who was more famous was this guy, Wu Zhihui, mm-hmm. right? A founding father of the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party.
Yes, you actually say in the chapter, one might say that if Lu Xun was the father of modern Chinese cursing, Wu Zhihui was the granddaddy. I love that. Sorry, I just needed to get that out there.
Because they always talked about him as old Wu. Mm-hmm. Like he's like the familiar old, you know, irascible grandfather to all of them. And, you know, Lu Xun had a lot of snide things to say about him, too. They weren't all enamored of him. But he was known for being an antic character. You know, magnetic personality. He always dressed in really slovenly clothes. You know, there's one, he was extremely famous because he had known Sun Yat-sen and they had been, you know, comrades in arms mm-hmm. early in the revolution. You know, whenever you see photographs of Chiang Kai-shek from this period, it's Wu Zhihui sitting next to him in Nanjing and the like. So very high up, but he supposedly refused to become an official. And no, I like to say he kept everyone at spitting distance and you know, would revile them and really, you know, really vile language, but playing for laughs. Or he would be invited to go, you know, give a speech at some college and arrive at the podium and like pull his speech out of his pocket. And, like all his change would fall on the floor. And so like him and the principal would like spend 5 minutes picking up all of his pennies.
Kind of like, wish that happened more often. That would make lectures more interesting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So he was like, he was all over the tabloids. Like they just mm-hmm. could not get enough of this guy. And so, the people who discovered this novel said, Wu Zhihui writes just like, the author of this novel. And so like this novel became tied to the celebrity of a guy who was known as a renowned reviler, Ming Ma, mm-hmm. right? He was someone who was famous for cursing. So I was interested in like at this historical period, you had people who were famous for cursing. Like that mm-hmm. was their style. And even Lu Xun, right? People talk about him now as being like a satirist, right? A feng zi jia. But to a lot of people he cursed, he was known as a mocker. And so so the novel gets into some of the, you know, personal politics of mockery.
Mm-hmm. So one of the really interesting things happening in this chapter, and there's a lot more that we could talk about. I mean, you sort of trace what happens in the novel and to its republication, conversations around it, or you use the novel and those transformations to trace other transformations between the late Qing or the mid Qing in the 1920s. So there's all kinds of other things we can talk about. But I want to just make sure we're talking a little bit about your own approach to these curses and to the translation of them. So one of the really interesting things happening in the book is that you give us a lot of primary source material in translation, right? There's some really great jokes in the book, really interesting sources, and just trying to, as a reader, trying to figure out how challenging it must have been and what your approaches must, you know, might have been to actually translating some of this material. It's a really interesting set of problems. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Can you speak at all to your experience as a translator and kind of renderer of some of this material, like the jokes here, the curses in particular? It seems like these pose a particular kind of challenge to the translator and someone who's writing about that. So what were some of the challenges for you in working with this kind of material and translating it?
Yeah, and I guess it, flexible would be the word, mm-hmm. trying to be flexible translator. So, you know, Ming Ma, obviously there's alliteration in the Chinese, so renowned reviler seems to make sense to me mm-hmm. to capture that in English. Or I gave the example, Gui, a very difficult term to translate. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a segue, you know, sex fiend, we have that term in English, so it's very handy because it's all, a fiend is obviously a type of devil or ghost. But Huosiren, living dead, seems to make more sense, or, you know, walking dead. So, like, dealing with that term, I had to be a bit more flexible. I don't think there's a particular secret to it. I would definitely admit that the my study has some selection bias in that, you know, try to go for stuff that I felt like I could translate mm-hmm. and, you know, jokes that translated well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of more elusive wordplay that is left out of this. You know, you could do a dedicated study just of doggerel verse from this period, mm-hmm. you know, from the late Qing and early Republican period. It was a huge genre. I'm sure someone could do, you know, is writing a story about, like, the Lantern Riddle and the Making of Modern China. Right? Lantern Riddles were hugely popular. And another thing that was just cataloged endlessly in this period. But, yeah, I think the book, one of the things it tries to demonstrate is that you can translate some of this stuff. We don't have to, like, abandon ourselves to this ridiculous notion that, like, humor gets lost in translation or poetry gets lost in translation. Mm-hmm. I think you can certainly try to, you know, replicate it. Mm-hmm. So readers would decide if it works or not, but feel like you have to try. And I didn't want to just be like explaining jokes mm-hmm. through the whole novel. I want them to really sing and, you know, speak for themselves.
So as we move from this chapter to the next chapter, we move into farce. Now, this is also really, really interesting. Chapter 5 looks very closely and playfully at scams, deceptions, and fraud in print media. And this is just, there's a lot of really interesting examples in here. You talk about the significance of farce to a culture that might be called funny Shanghai, right? So that's the context in which some of these examples I'll ask you about exist. In 1928, there was a case of a mysterious woman named Qiu Suwen. Can you talk about that for us? What's going on there? And in this woman's playthings, and why is that important to what's happening in this chapter? So basically, who was Qiu Suwen, and how might we use that example to open up what's happening in this chapter for listeners?
Yeah, Qiu Suwen in 1928 was this really well-known female literatus and painter, right? So it's like her poetry would appear in literary magazines, her paintings would appear at art exhibitions, but nobody had ever seen her. She was this mysterious figure. And then one day in the newspaper, there was an advertisement saying that Miss Qiu was looking for a husband. And so, you know, all these men, over 1,000 men, mm-hmm. you know, wrote, you know, asking for her hand in marriage. And so she wrote back to them and arranged a date at a park. And she said, you know, I'll wear green, you know, please wear a flower on your lapel. And so when the day came, there were like 1,234 men milling about the park wearing a flower.
It's an amazing image, right?
But she didn't show up. Mm-hmm. And so all the men are bewildered, and of course, like, what the heck is going on? And the next day, each of them receives a letter saying, "Hey, I went to the, my friend went to the park to scope things out for me and saw like all of these guys running about. Like, is he pulling some kind of hoax or practical joke here? What's going on?" And so the men don't know what was going on, but they apologize. And she's like, "Okay, okay, we'll have another date at the cinema." And so, you know, on date night, there are again 1,234 men sitting in the cinema, having each bought, you know, a couple of tickets, looking around like for their absent date. And, you know, this time he's mad. Like, he doesn't know what the heck is going on. We're told, you know, it turns out that she had actually rented out the cinema for that night and, you know, made a packet off these suitors and took her girlfriends to Hangzhou to go play. And so the guys, you know, again, try to contact her, having seen, you know, a notice in the paper that Miss Cho had been in an accident on the way to her date and was now at such and such a hospital, like recuperating from minor injuries and the like. So again, it's this like three-part attempt. And eventually, like, each of the men writes to her and is like, "Please let me know where you live, you know, and I'll come and visit you." And so she gives all of the men each other's addresses. And so they end up going to each other's homes. So this is a story, right? You know, this is a fictional character that made up by a guy named Xu Zhuodai, who was like Mr. Funny Shanghai in the 1920s and 30s. And like, he's a remarkable character in of himself, right? He was from Suzhou. He had studied in Japan, but he studied like physical education, not, you know, not mining or something. And he studied ballroom dance. He came back to Shanghai and he and his wife founded like these gymnastics academies. He later, in the 1910s and 20s, worked in the theater, various theater troupes. A lot of the pioneers of Chinese drama, modern Chinese drama, like Ouyang Yuqian, so on and so forth, were members of his troupes. He co-founded two film companies, right? The Happy Film Company, Kaixin Yingpian Gongsi, made a lot of slapstick shorts in the mid-1920s. He wrote advertisements for The Great World. He worked in radio broadcasting and, you know, performed funny routines. He translated Japanese drama. And so he did everything, right? He founded a soy sauce company.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah, like artificial soy sauce. I still don't know what it is. But yeah, he and his second wife, you know, became like petty entrepreneurs. And like, so I think of him as being like a comic entrepreneur. And what he was really known for was being a funny guy. And so there's all this like literary field gossip that you see in the newspapers and magazines about, you know, the latest funny stuff that Xu Zhuodai has been up to and his latest pranks. But he and some other writers from that period really thought that Shanghai was like an absurd and funny place, and that, you know, is now awash in deceptive advertisements and like con men run amok. And so this was like his muse. And so he developed what I think of as being a huaji aesthetic. That was the term that was most closely tied to him, that was very farcical. And like the hoax or the practical joke was really what made it work. And so he wrote all of these narratives and he created these figures like Harry Lee, you know, Li Amao, Dr. Li Amao, who would, you know, have an open column, kind of like Dear Abby, where people could write to him at like for life advice and he would write back. And so this character became a figure of short stories, of, you know, movies made about him. But it was very accessible, you know, appealed to all ages, and it was essentially a trickster figure. So I was curious, you know, why do we need tricksters in the modern age? And it seemed, you know, very closely connected to a type of Shanghai ethos. Shanghai is a very slippery place.
Yeah. You should sponsor or hold that conference as well, Tricksters.
That's
right. That's amazing.
It's coming up. Just wait.
And in fact, this chapter...
Dear listeners, you can get advanced tickets now for only $25. Just send them to the department address.
Your
place will be reserved.
Exactly. Your place will be reserved. Wear a flower on your lapel when you show up to the conference.
Just come to Vancouver.
So So the chapter talked a lot about these different kinds of practical jokes that print media would play on readers, and I won't go into any more detail so that we can move in further into the book, but you talk about plagiarism and fake advertisements, and in general, this spirit of hoaxing and hoaxsters. It's a really, really fascinating chapter, and also really funny. But before we finish the book and the interview, we have to talk about the invention of humor. So humor hasn't been invented yet. Let's invent it. And we get there in chapter six. In the 1930s, as you tell us here in chapter six, in opposition to the kind of farce that we've been talking about, and cursing coalesced into a campaign to, as you put it, change the tone of public discourse. You say that the result might be called the invention of humor. So can you talk about that? What do you mean here by the invention of humor, and how did this represent an important reaction to and shift from what we've been talking about?
Yeah, and it's most people who've written about modern Chinese humor have started with Lin Yutang, who in 1924, the story goes, you know, invented this term, yōmuō, you know, a transliteration of humor. And but then there was like an 8-year gap or so until 1932. He founded the Analex Fortnightly, this humor magazine, loosely, you know, imitating like the New Yorker, slightly more highbrow. But it was going to be known for humor and kind of promote Lin Yutang's notion of humor. Mm-hmm. 1924 was around, you know, it's just a couple years before Wish Classic, you know, Hudian, was published. So it was in that period when everyone was mocking everybody else.
And He Dian, for listeners, was the one with all the curses that were
the
characters.
Devils,
and
all the devils, ghosts, right? Yeah. So I think Lin Yutang in the 1920s was kind of responding to that. But he essentially felt like, you know, the farcers were just absurd. The players, you know, the Yoxi people were all trivial. The jokers were trivial. Mm-hmm. And everyone was just way too cynical. Mm-hmm. And so essentially all of these comic traditions that China had were not appropriate for the modern age because they were like self-defeating or just irrelevant. And he thought really what Chinese people needed was humor. And he defined humor in a very particular way, right? He thought that it was tolerant, it was humane, right? It could see the humanity in people's folly, you know, whether they're common people, delusive, or even grasping officials and the like. He also talked about it as a way to avoid getting shot. Like there was actual peril in criticizing the government into the 1930s, in a very repressive Kuomintang state. And so he could, you know, adopt something of an ironic pose as an individual to make clothed criticisms. But the main thing that he wanted people to kind of embrace a different philosophy that was confident. You know, self-confident. Like there's so much self-flagellating among Chinese intellectuals. Oh, China is weak and backwards and so on and so forth, and we need to whip the populace to greater efforts. But Lin Yutang was this very cosmopolitan guy. You know, he knew multiple languages. He studied at Harvard. He'd done a PhD in Leipzig and the like. And he moved in slightly different circles, which did open him to the criticism of being elitist, right? Lu Xun, who also wrote for Lin Yutang's magazine, said, you know, you're like the Knights of the Round Table. Like, only people at the top of the hierarchy can really enjoy humor. Mm. The peasants are being bombed. Mm. They're like, so if you're, like, forcing humor down their throat, you know, you're being both pedantic and unrealistic. But, amazingly, like, his vision of humor and this catchword really caught on in the 1930s. And it was a movement that lasted 30 years, and excuse me, not 30 years, it lasted for most of the 1930s. You know, it brought in a lot of major talent, leading lights, as well as kind of up-and-coming writers, you know, people a decade or two younger than him, including Qian Zhongshu, who had a lot of negative things to say about Lin Yutang. But it was a movement that was that did kind of trickle down and become very popular and became like the word for humor and kind of swept away Hua Ji and Yoshi and like Xiao Ma, you know, it's modern. People still talk about modern. But Yomo became like the gold standard for humor in China. And I think that's still true today. So even though it, you know, during the war period, You know, we need something more militant. We need satire. We need mockery to attack the Japanese devils. We also, you know, in the Mao era, we want to elevate Lu Xun. We want satire. We don't want this kind of gentlemanly, refined bourgeois humor. But it's back. You know, it's back again. And people apply the term much more broadly. But so I talk about in that chapter about how this kind of came to be and what some of the implications were. And also, you know, people often talk about Yomo as being like a fad of the 1930s. My guess is it would have continued a little bit longer if it hadn't been for the invasion of China by a certain country in 1937.
Right. Thank you. So as we come to sort of toward our close, we also come to the close of the book. And there's a few really, really interesting things happening in the epilogue that talk about what happens later, right? What happens after. And you say here in the epilogue, this was modern China's first, but not last, age of irreverence. So you take us through some important kind of landmarks along that, the lines of those later historical periods. You talk a little bit about Mao Zedong, but then you bring us into a discussion of 21st century digital online humor and the ways that some of the phenomena you've been talking about kind of play out in this context. So because it's super relevant, it's super interesting, we are in fact contributing to the online landscape by even putting this out there and doing what we're doing right now.
Chinese translation forthcoming.
Chinese translation forthcoming, I'm sure. Send your check to department and make sure there's a little flower in there. But can you talk a little bit about that? For you, what are some of the most interesting things happening in terms of the digital landscape of humor in the 21st century in Chinese?
Yeah, I mentioned the 21st century context at the end, partly to draw a parallel or to point out some resonances in that, you know, in the early 20th century, you had print as kind of the new platform. Obviously, it had been around for a long time, but the volume of print really gave an opportunity for the flourishing of this these new cultures of laughter. And so I think we see a similar thing going on with, you know, the blog era and, you know, with websites and other digital media where you can circulate memes, you can circulate jokes, you can circulate, you know, gag images very readily. And so I see this as being partly an echo of an earlier age. And I think you could call it an age of irreverence with some new limitations. I think the reach of the state in terms of censorship is much greater. Kuomintang state, you know, had very crude methods of, you know, assassination and the like. Yuan Shikai would, you know, prohibit the post office from circulating magazines that he didn't like. Right now we have the 50-cent party, the Wu Maodang, censoring people left and right. So you have similar cat and mouse stuff going on at a much vaster scale. So both the humor and the repression, I think, have increased dramatically. And I try to just gesture in that direction because it's so complex and it really does deserve another study. I think my own next move will probably be, you know, I chopped my dissertation in half, essentially, and added some more stuff to write this book. I like to revisit some of the earlier material taking us through the war and into the Mao era. But I think there's, you know, there are people working on this and who, you know, pay great attention to what's going on in China nowadays, especially online, because that's where a lot of the edgiest stuff occurs, right? And humor is often most fun on those boundaries. So I think there's a lot of wordplay going on. I just give just one or two examples in the book where people create new words, like the portmanteau or characters. They mash them together to express something new. There's a lot of punning to avoid keyword filters by censors. And so I think it's extremely relevant. And, you know, there's a lot of brilliant things going on in China. So I definitely recommend China Digital Times, right, which has cataloged a lot of these in the Grass Mud Horse lexicon. And there are other, you know, similar efforts underway. So I think this is an evolving story that's extremely important. And I do think that this tone of irreverence towards authority is in some ways proportional to the amount of repression.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I'm obviously hopeful that the repression will fall away and crumble. And I do think that when you have enough collective mockery and kind of contempt, mm-hmm. open contempt, it can start to chip away at the foundation of repression. But I'm not in the business of making predictions. I'm more interested in what we've got now and what we've had.
Of course. So the last thing that I'll ask you before we kind of move to the conclusion is just another thing that you mentioned in the epilogue, which is a case that's gotten a lot of attention in the past few years, and that's the giving of the Nobel Prize in Literature to Moyen, right? And you talk in the epilogue about the resulting controversy around that and the ways that that helps us think through these issues of the book a little bit more as well. So would you mind speaking briefly to that insofar as it kind of animates some of the things that's, you know, that are going on in the book as a way of kind of bringing us toward our conclusion?
Sure. Well, I mentioned, you know, at several points in the book and in our talk today that these different types of laughter have often been denigrated, especially by historians, you know, mostly as being trivial, right? People accept that it's, you know, a part of life, but as a literary form, you know, C.T. Shaw once said that, you know, the humorist is always a minor writer. I love that takedown. That's great. I don't know if I'd agree when it comes to, like, Dickens. Right. But at any rate, that's kind of what we deal with. And so I think it's quite interesting that, you know, the first Chinese citizen, let's be clear about that, right? Not Gao Xingjian, that Frenchman. The first Chinese citizen of the People's Republic of China, to win this kind of consummate international literary prize, the Nobel Prize for Literature, is a novelist known, yes, for writing about trauma and brutality, but often in a very farcical key, right, that is irreverent and profane and humorous, mm-hmm. right? You know, you'd have to be kind of demagoguish to, you know, deny that Moyen tries to amuse people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's definitely a big part of his literary persona. And so it's kind of like this, you know, trauma and suffering in a key of laughter is one of the things that propelled him to victory. So now he's been elevated, right? Like, he's at the top of China's literary hierarchy, at least putatively. We all have our opinions about the actual merit of his literary output, but I think that's an interesting moment.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that gets into the notion of, like, you know, hierarchies within literary sphere or, you know, any creative field. About the particular politics of the People's Republic of China nowadays. And, you know, it's already a moment that's passed. You know, Moyen is still on the scene, still writing. And it'll be interesting to see if people, you know, start imitating his style. But, you know, to be sure, China has a lot of, you know, active humorists and satirists mm-hmm. out there. And we also have new words, right? That's one of the things I point in the epilogue. You know, people talk about gao xiao. Right, just make laughter, just make it, just do it, right? And this is like a new umbrella term, especially tied to, like, youth, but also connected to, you know, the Mao era, when you want to gao ge ming, right? You want to make revolution by any means necessary.
And that is a great note on which to come to our conclusion. So, Chris, there's, of course, a bunch of stuff that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't get to but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I think one important thing is my book is definitely not the last word mm-hmm. on Chinese humor or even of the humor of that particular historical period, right? Roughly the 1890s to 1930s. One of the things at the end of the book is an appendix that lists, you know, over 100 different humor collections in multiple genres. But my hope is that, you know, this is a treasure trove that people can draw on for future research. And there's a lot more work to be done on amusement halls, for example, Shanghai amusement halls, right? You also find them in Singapore, throughout British Malaya, and the like. Very influential institutions that last into the Mao era, you know, have been revived again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of mass entertainment model. So I think that, and of course, there's plenty more work to be done on the Mao era and the reform era. So, or, you know, underground humor during the Cultural Revolution. So there's still plenty more out there, and I hope that this book will kind of
you know,
encourage other people to take the plunge and not worry about the approbation of their colleagues.
And speaking of treasure troves, I hear word that there's also perhaps a bonus footnote or a bonus endnote somewhere in the book. And so I don't know. Is that?
I don't know.
Maybe
only in select editions. So you have to, you know, buy as many copies as you can. Right. Find the one with the bonus endnote.
Exactly.
It's like the, you know, the golden
the
ticket.
The golden ticket.
The golden ticket.
No, rumors.
The Wonka chocolate bar.
So, Chris, now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you currently working on?
Working on my tan, but apart from that, we're not getting much sunlight here in Vancouver right now. But, my colleague Bruce Rusk and I are translating a Ming Dynasty collection, supposedly China's first collection of swindle stories.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Bruce
Rusk? Bruce Rusk. I might Run be married to him.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah,
that's
that
right.
Guy. That guy.
Yes, my colleague in Asian studies and fantastic scholar of the Ming Dynasty.
Very handsome.
Very,
well,
handsome,
very handsome.
Handsome, svelte, dapper.
But anyway,
sorry, what were we talking about again?
Swindles.
Swindles, that's right, swindles. This is a book that we're calling it The Book of Swindles.
Mm-hmm.
And but it had a much longer title. It was like, you know, a new book for foiling swindlers based on worldly experience. It's like Jianghu Lilan Du Pian Xin Shu. Really, really interesting book. It's a short work. We don't know much about the author, Zhang Yingyu, but he believed that the late Ming was an era of decay and swindlers run amok. And if you're a businessman on the road, like, watch out, because, you know, your fellow travelers may be swindling you. There are all of these, you know, ne'er-do-well monks and nuns cavorting about. And so this was supposedly like the handbook. You needed to know all the tricks of the trade so you could avoid being duped. So you can see how this interest draw comes out of my focus on Shanghai, where it's like Shanghai is a slippery place. And actually you had similar collections being compiled in the late Qing and the Republican era, including by Wu Jianren. You know, Wu Jianren wrote about blind fortune tellers. Not just any old fortune tellers, but blind fortune tellers were particularly devious and would bilk you out of all your money. Don't trust them. And so I'm interested in kind of cultures of deception and notions of deception as well. So you see, I've like, you know, gone downhill from laughter to to swindles. But I think it's fascinating, and this is a really remarkable collection. And you see some of the archetypal figures and scenarios in this book being adapted into like Rulin Wai Shi, into the scholars, like the, you know, the most famous Chinese satirical novel of all time. And so I'm interested in its cultural influence, and we're starting by translating the stories, and I hope to do a kind of broader study of Chinese notions of deception and stories of Chinese deception from the outside as well as the kind of within the Chinese narrative tradition.
Great. Well, best of luck. If we can track down this Bruce Rusk guy, maybe I'll interview you again when that book is out, so we can find him.
And I should mention, I seem to have lost my wallet, so I may need bus fare to get back across town.
Okay. Well, we'll talk. We'll see what we can do. Oh, and listeners, if you have any bus fare and you want to help Chris out, but no. In the meantime, thank you so much for being here and for talking about such a great book, a playful book. And it's really been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.